Just as we were getting into my car to start on a trip to Central Mexico on October 5th, 1968, Don Juan stopped me. "I have told you before," he said with a serious expression, "that one should never reveal the name nor the whereabouts of a sorcerer. I believe you understood that you should never reveal my name nor the place where my body is. Now I'm going to ask you to do the same with a friend of mine, a friend you will call Gennaro. We are going to his house. We'll spend some time there." I assured Don Juan that I had never betrayed his confidence. "I know that," he said without changing his serious expression. "Yet I'm concerned with your becoming thoughtless." I protested, and Don Juan said his aim was only to remind me that every time one was careless in matters of sorcery, one was playing with an imminent and senseless death that could be averted by being thoughtful and aware. "We will not touch upon this matter any longer," he said. "Once we leave my house, we will not mention Gennaro, nor will we think about him. I want you to put your thoughts in order now. When you meet him, you must be clear and have no doubts in your mind." "What kind of doubts are you referring to, Don Juan?" "Any kind of doubts, whatever. When you meet him, you ought to be crystal clear. He will see you." His strange admonitions made me very apprehensive. I mentioned that perhaps I should not meet his friend at all, but only drive to the vicinity of his friend's house and leave him there. "What I've told you was only a precaution," he said. "You've met one sorcerer already, Vicente, and he nearly killed you. Watch out this time." After we arrived in Central Mexico, it took us 2 days to walk from where I left my car to his friend's house, a little shack perched on the side of a mountain. Don Juan's friend was at the door as if he had been waiting for us. "You're welcome to my humble little shack," he said apologetically in Spanish. His words were a polite formula I had heard before in various rural areas of Mexico. Yet as he said the words, he laughed joyously for no overt reason, and I knew he was exercising his controlled folly. He did not care in the least that his house was a shack. I liked Don Gennaro very much. For the next 2 days, we went into the mountains to collect plants. Don Juan, Don Gennaro, and I left each day at the crack of dawn. We returned to the house in the late afternoon, and both days I was so tired that I fell asleep immediately. The third day, however, was different. The three of us worked together, and Don Juan asked Don Gennaro to teach me how to select certain plants. We returned around noon, and the old men sat for hours in front of the house in complete silence, as if they were in a state of trance. "You must talk to the plants before you pick them," Don Juan said. He dropped his words casually and repeated his statement three times, as if to catch my attention. Nobody had said a word until he spoke. It was late in the afternoon. Don Juan was sitting on a flat rock facing the western mountains. Don Gennaro was sitting by him on a straw mat with his face toward the north. Don Juan had told me the first day we were there that those were their positions and that I had to sit on the ground at any place opposite to both of them. Don Gennaro was staring at me. I was taking notes, and that seemed to baffle him. He smiled at me, shook his head, and said something to Don Juan. Don Juan shrugged his shoulders. I glanced at Don Gennaro and saw him performing a most unusual act. He was standing on his head without the aid of his arms or hands, and his legs were crossed as if he were sitting. The sight was so incongruous that it made me jump. When I realized he was doing something almost impossible from the point of view of body mechanics, he had gone back again to a normal sitting position. Don Juan, however, seemed to be cognizant of what was involved and celebrated Don Gennaro's performance with roaring laughter. Don Gennaro seemed to have noticed my confusion. He clapped his hands a couple of times and rolled on the ground again. Apparently, he wanted me to watch him. What had at first appeared to be rolling on the ground was actually leaning over in a sitting position and touching the ground with his head. He seemingly attained his illogical posture by gaining momentum, leaning over several times until the inertia carried his body to a vertical stand, so that for an instant he sat on his head. The two of them had another moment of mirth, then Don Juan became serious again, and said that if I did not think of my death, my entire life would be only a personal chaos. He looked very stern. "What else can a man have except his life and his death?" he said to me. At that point I felt it was indispensable to take notes, and I began writing again. Don Gennaro stared at me and smiled. Then he tilted his head back a little and opened his nostrils. He apparently had remarkable control over the muscles operating his nostrils because they opened up to perhaps twice their normal size. What was most comical about his clowning was not so much his gestures as his own reactions to them. After he enlarged his nostrils, he tumbled down, laughing, and worked his body again into the same strange sitting on his head upside down posture. Don Juan laughed until tears rolled down his cheeks. I felt a bit embarrassed and laughed nervously. Don Juan looked at me, still laughing, and said that his friend was portraying me, that my tendency was to open my nostrils whenever I wrote, and that Don Gennaro thought that trying to become a sorcerer by taking notes was as absurd as sitting on one's head, and thus he had made up the ludicrous posture of resting the weight of his sitting body on his head. "Perhaps you don't think it's funny," Don Juan said, "but only Gennaro can work his way up to sitting on his head, and only you can think of learning to be a sorcerer by writing your way up." They both had another explosion of laughter, and Don Gennaro repeated his incredible movement. I liked him. There was so much grace and directness in his acts. "Which direction is the wind?" Don Gennaro asked casually. Don Juan pointed to the west with a movement of his head. "I'd better go where the wind blows," Don Gennaro said with a serious expression. He then turned and shook his finger at me. "And don't you pay any attention if you hear strange noises," he said. "When Gennaro shits, the mountains tremble." He leaped into the bushes, and a moment later I heard a very strange noise, a deep, unearthly rumble. I did not know what to make of it. I looked at Don Juan for a clue, but he was doubled over with laughter. October 17, 1968. I don't remember what prompted Don Gennaro to tell me about the arrangement of the other world, as he called it. When he had finished talking, Don Juan looked at me and smiled knowingly. "Talking is not Gennaro's predilection," he said. "But if you care to get a lesson, he will teach you about the equilibrium of things." Don Gennaro nodded affirmatively. He puckered up his mouth and closed his eyelids halfway. I thought his gesture was delightful. Don Gennaro stood up, and so did Don Juan. "All right," Don Gennaro said. "Let's go, then. We could go and wait for Nestor and Pablito. They're through now. On Thursdays, they're through early." Both of them got into my car. Don Juan sat in the front. I did not ask them anything, but simply started the engine. Don Juan directed me to a place he said was Nestor's home. Don Gennaro went into the house, and a while later came out with Nestor and Pablito, two young men who were his apprentices. They all got in my car, and Don Juan told me to take the road toward the western mountains. We left my car on the side of the dirt road and walked along the bank of a river, which was perhaps 15 or 20 feet across, to a waterfall that was visible from where I had parked. It was late afternoon. The scenery was quite impressive. We stopped at the bottom of the waterfall. It was perhaps 150 feet high. The roar was very loud. Don Gennaro fastened a belt around his waist. He had at least 7 items hanging from it. They looked like small gourds. The belt seemed to be made of woven strips of leather. I could not see whether he tied it or buckled it. Don Gennaro walked toward the waterfall. Don Juan manipulated a round rock into a steady position and sat down on it. The other two young men did the same with some rocks and sat down to his left. Don Juan pointed to the place next to him on his right side and told me to bring a rock and sit by him. "We must make a line here," he said, showing me that the three were sitting in a row. By then, Don Gennaro had reached the very bottom of the waterfall and had begun climbing a trail on the right side of it. From where we were sitting, the trail looked fairly steep. There were lots of shrubs he used as railings. At one moment, he seemed to lose his footing and almost slid down as if the dirt were slippery. A moment later, the same thing happened, and the thought crossed my mind that perhaps Don Gennaro was too old to be climbing. I saw him slipping and stumbling several times before he reached the spot where the trail ended. Don Juan was looking straight at Don Gennaro. His gaze was fixed. His eyelids were half closed. He was sitting very erect with his hands resting between his legs on the edge of the rock. Don Gennaro had climbed quite a way on the rocky wall. At the moment I looked, he was perched on a ledge, inching his way slowly to circumvent a huge boulder. His arms were spread as if he were embracing the rock. He moved slowly toward his right, and suddenly he lost his footing. I gasped involuntarily. For a moment, his whole body hung in the air. I was sure he was going to fall, but he did not. His right hand had grabbed onto something, and very agilely his feet went back on the ledge again. But before he moved on, he turned to us and looked. It was only a glance. There was, however, such a stylization to the movement of turning his head that I began to wonder. I remembered then that he had done the same thing, turning to look at us every time he slipped. I had thought that Don Gennaro must have felt embarrassed by his clumsiness and turned to see if we were looking. He climbed a bit more toward the top, suffered another loss of footing, and hung perilously on the overhanging rock face. This time he was supported by his left hand. When he regained his balance, he turned and looked at us again. He slipped twice more before he reached the top. From where we were sitting, the crest of the waterfall seemed to be 20 to 25 feet across. Don Gennaro stood motionless for a moment. I wanted to ask Don Juan what Don Gennaro was going to do up there, but Don Juan seemed to be so absorbed in watching that I did not dare disturb him. Suddenly, Don Gennaro jumped onto the water. It was such a thoroughly unexpected action that I felt a vacuum in the pit of my stomach. It was a magnificent, outlandish leap. For a second, I had the clear sensation that I had seen a series of superimposed images of his body making an elliptical flight to the middle of the stream. When my surprise receded, I noticed that he had landed on a rock on the edge of the fall, a rock which was barely visible from where we were sitting. He stayed perched there for a long time. He seemed to be fighting the power of the onrushing water. Twice he hung over the precipice, and I could not determine what he was clinging to. He gained his balance and squatted on the rock, then he leaped again like a tiger. I could barely see the next rock where he landed. It was like a small cone on the very edge of the fall. He remained there almost 10 minutes. He was motionless. His immobility was so impressive to me that I was shivering. I wanted to get up and walk around. Don Juan noticed my nervousness and told me imperatively to be calm. Don Gennaro's stillness plunged me into an extraordinary and mysterious terror. I felt that if he remained perched there any longer, I could not control myself. Suddenly he jumped again, this time all the way to the other bank of the waterfall. He landed on his feet and hands like a feline. He remained in a squat position for a moment, then he stood up and looked across the fall to the other side and then down at us. He stayed dead still looking at us. His hands were clasped at his sides as if he were holding on to an unseen railing. There was something truly exquisite about his posture. His body seemed so nimble, so frail. I thought that Don Gennaro, with his headband and feathers, his dark poncho and his bare feet, was the most beautiful human being I had ever seen. He threw his arms up suddenly, lifted his head, and flipped his body swiftly in a sort of lateral somersault to his left. The boulder where he had been standing was round, and when he jumped, he disappeared behind it. Huge drops of rain began to fall at that moment. Don Juan got up, and so did the two young men. Their movement was so abrupt that it confused me. Don Gennaro's masterful feat had thrown me into a state of profound emotional excitement. I felt he was a consummate artist, and I wanted to see him right then to applaud him. I strained to look on the left side of the waterfall to see if he was coming down, but he was not. I insisted on knowing what happened to him. Let him be wherever he is. Perhaps he is an eagle flying to the other world, or perhaps he has died up there. It doesn't matter now. October 23rd, 1968. Don Juan casually mentioned that he was going to make another trip to Central Mexico in the near future. Are you going to visit Don Gennaro? I asked. Perhaps, he said without looking at me. He's all right, isn't he, Don Juan? I mean, nothing bad happened to him up there on top of the waterfall, did it? Nothing happened to him. He is sturdy. Don Juan looked at me and said in a mischievous tone, You're dying to ask me about Gennaro's lesson, aren't you? I laughed with embarrassment. I had been obsessed with everything that took place at the waterfall. Gennaro risked a great deal to show you something magnificent. Too bad you can't see. Seeing is very difficult, he said. I begged him to explain his statement. Seeing is not a matter of talk, he said imperatively. Obviously, he was not going to tell me anything more, so I gave up and left the house to run some errands for him. When I returned, it was already dark. We had something to eat, and afterwards we walked out to the Ramada. We had no sooner sat down than Juan began to talk about Don Gennaro's lesson. He said that Don Gennaro, being a master of balance, could perform very complex and difficult movements. The action of sitting on his head without the aid of his hands was at best a freakish stunt that lasted only an instant. In Don Gennaro's opinion, writing about seeing was the same. That is, it was a precarious maneuver, as odd and as unnecessary as sitting on one's head. Don Juan peered at me in the dark and in a very dramatic tone said that while Don Gennaro was horsing around sitting on his head, I was on the very verge of seeing. Don Gennaro noticed it and repeated his maneuvers over and over to no avail because I had lost the thread right away. Don Juan said that afterwards Don Gennaro, moved by his personal liking for me, attempted in a very dramatic way to bring me back to that verge of seeing. After very careful deliberation, he decided to show me a feat of equilibrium by crossing the waterfall. He felt that the waterfall was like the edge on which I was standing, and was confident I could also make it across. Don Juan then explained Don Gennaro's feat. He said that he had already told me that human beings were, for those who saw, luminous beings composed of something like fibers of light, which rotated from the front to the back and maintained the appearance of an egg. He said that he had also told me that the most astonishing part of the egg-like creatures was a set of long fibers that came out of the area around the navel. Don Juan said that those fibers were of the utmost importance in the life of a man. Those fibers were the secret of Don Gennaro's balance, and his lesson had nothing to do with acrobatic jumps across the waterfall. His feat of equilibrium was in the way he used those tentacle-like fibers. Don Juan dropped the subject as suddenly as he had started it and began to talk about something thoroughly unrelated. October 24th, 1968. I cornered Don Juan and told him I intuitively felt that I was never going to get another lesson in equilibrium, and that he had to explain to me all the pertinent details which I would otherwise never discover by myself. Don Juan said I was right, insofar as knowing that Don Gennaro would never give me another lesson. "What else do you want to know?" he asked. "What are those tentacle-like fibers, Don Juan?" "They are the tentacles that come out of a man's body, which are apparent to any sorcerer who sees. Sorcerers act toward people in accordance to the way they see their tentacles. Weak persons have very short, almost invisible fibers. Strong persons have bright, long ones. Gennaro's, for instance, are so bright that they resemble thickness. You can tell from the fibers if a person is healthy, or if he is sick, or if he is mean, or kind, or treacherous. You can also tell from the fibers if a person can see. Here is a baffling problem. When Gennaro saw you, he knew, just like my friend Vicente did, that you could see. When I see you, I see that you can see, and yet I know myself that you can't. How baffling. Gennaro couldn't get over that. I told him that you were a strange fool. I think he wanted to see that for himself and took you to the waterfall. You think everything in the world is simple to understand, he said, because everything you do is a routine that is simple to understand. At the waterfall, when you looked at Gennaro moving across the water, you believed that he was a master of somersaults, because somersaults was all you could think about, and that is all you will ever believe he did. Yet Gennaro never jumped across that water. If he had jumped, he would have died. Gennaro balanced himself on his superb, bright fibers. He made them long enough so that he could, let's say, roll on them across the waterfall. He demonstrated the proper way to make those tentacles long and how to move them with precision. Pablito saw nearly all of Gennaro's movements. Nestor, on the other hand, saw only the most obvious maneuvers. He missed the delicate details. But you saw nothing. If you could see, he said, it would have been obvious to you from the first step that Gennaro took that he was not slipping as he went up the side of the waterfall. He was loosening his tentacles. Twice he made them go around boulders and held to the sheer rock like a fly. When he got to the top and was ready to cross the water, he focused them onto a small rock in the middle of the stream, and when they were secured there, he let the fibers pull him. Gennaro never jumped. Therefore, he could land on the slippery surfaces of small boulders at the very edge of the water. His fibers were at all times neatly wrapped around every rock he used. He did not stay on the first boulder very long because he had the rest of his fibers tied onto another one, even smaller, at the place where the onrush of water was the greatest. His tentacles pulled him again, and he landed on it. That was the most outstanding thing he did. The surface was too small for a man to hold on to, and the onrush of the water would have washed his body over the precipice had he not had some of his fibers still focused on the first rock. He stayed in that second position for a long time, because he had to draw out his tentacles again and send them across to the other side of the fall. When he had them secured, he had to release the fibers focused on the first rock. That was very tricky. Perhaps only Gennaro could do that. He nearly lost his grip. Or maybe he was only fooling us. We'll never know that for sure. Personally, I really think he nearly lost his grip. I know that because he became rigid and sent out a magnificent shoot like a beam of light across the water. I feel that beam alone could have pulled him through. When he got to the other side, he stood up and let his fibers glow like a cluster of lights. That was the one thing he did just for you. If you had been able to see, you would have seen that. Gennaro stood there looking at you, and then he knew that you had not seen.